We reversed course. And in some of these hot regions, now we're seeing prices are dropping almost as rapidly as they went up. But again, that is not stability. And nobody wants to participate in a market that has unstable pricing. So it's broken. Like, the Fed put all this money into it and it doesn't work.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Historically low interest rates and central bank stimulus resulted in a record decade for housing price gains leading up to 2021. But then the Fed and many other central banks reversed policy. Interest rates have rocketed higher and the stimulus spigots have turned off. Mortgages are now more than twice as expensive than they were just 2 years ago. As home prices are now weakening nationwide and globally too, homeowners around the world are asking, if a correction is now in process, how bad's it going to get? To help us better understand the key dynamics in play, Amy Nixon returns to the program. She appeared on this channel several months ago to warn us of the brewing trouble in the short-term rental market, which she coined the Airbnb bust, a warning that quickly proved prophetic. And if we have time, I'll ask her for an update on that unfolding correction as well. Amy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Adam. It's good to be here.
Hey, it's such a pleasure. Nice to put a face to a name. All right, Amy, lots of questions for you. A lot's happened in the housing market since we talked last. If you don't mind, though, I'd like just to sort of start at a high level to sort of jump the discussion off here. What's your current assessment of the U.S. housing market?
Honestly, the housing market's been insane for 3 years straight. And arguably, you know, you could say for a decade prior to this, but we basically have gone through a whiplash with what we had in 2021. We had extreme price instability with prices in a lot of regions climbing 2 or 3% a month, which is typically what you would see in annual appreciation. And this went on throughout most of 2021 or all of 2021 and part of 2022. And the Fed finally slammed on the brakes, and they slammed them pretty hard with the rate hikes, because about 6 or 7 months ago, you saw just a complete stop in activity in housing. The rates essentially doubled overnight, which is extreme. A lot of people focus on, oh, you know, rates are still on average historically low at 6 or 7%. But you can't look at the average. You have to look at the rate of change and how quickly the rates change, because that's really what affects how consumers view the market, and that affects affordability, with prices still being basically priced for a 3% interest rate. So in the summer, we had this brake slam on, activity stopped, kind of that went on all through the end of 2022. And it sort of felt like the housing market's dead. We saw these articles, you know, people were like, is housing dead? Demand is dead. And then we came into 2023 and we got a little bit of signs of life. There was some uptick in activity, mortgage applications bumped up a little bit, interest rates dropped a tiny bit. And everybody in the industry got excited. They were like, maybe we bottomed. No, but that was sort of the sentiment that we had, I would say, in January and early February, was this hopeful little uptick of, and it coincided with what was happening in the stock market too. Just this idea that, hey, maybe we can get a soft landing for everything. And maybe the worst of housing is over. Maybe this was just a sharp, brief correction. But I don't think that it was. And I think it was just yesterday, we got the newest mortgage application data, and it was really bad. It was the lowest it's been for the 21st century. So rates are back almost at 7%. And once again, I think we're finding ourselves with demand is just being sledgehammered into the ground. So while you might hear some people say, oh, you know, there's bidding wars in my region, or there's not a lot of inventory, that's true. But demand is what's being killed, because really all the Fed can do is kill demand. Their tools are a blunt sledgehammer, and it can kill demand. They can't create supply. They can't build homes. So right now we're in this sort of stalemate-like situation where people who bought homes at these low interest rates don't want to sell them. And people who, and they're not in distress yet, so they're going to hold on to those homes. And people still want to buy homes, and there's not a lot of inventory. So sellers are sort of still able to hold out for these kind of ridiculously high prices, just based on the fact that inventory is still tight.
All right, got it. So I've sort of likened this to, you know, throwing somebody, you know, off a ship in the Arctic, right? You know, their body temperature just changes so rapidly as they get thrown, you know, into the frigid waters there, right? And there's, you know, this period where a body goes into shock. And then, you know, you're wondering, okay, does the person recover, or do organs start to go into system failure, right? And it's almost sort of like a Wile E. Coyote moment, right, where he runs off the cliff and he's waiting for gravity to take place here, right? So we've shocked the system with all these rate hikes that you just mentioned, right? The fastest pace of rate hikes ever, really. And the magnitude is, you know, yes, we're not up at the interest rates that we, or the mortgage rates that we saw, say, back in the mid-80s. But, you know, from below 3 to, in certain cases, you know, 7-8%, that's a real material change for a lot of people. And as you said, you know, we sort of shocked the system and everyone's sort of looking around waiting to see, okay, are we going to get better or are we going to go into organ failure here? And, you know, one of the things I find that's top of my mind is, look, you and I will probably talk through a litany of things that are probably going to be kind of adding gravity to housing prices, but let's put all of them aside except just for the change in mortgage rates, right?
Okay.
They're more than double than what they were 2 years ago. Just mathematically, home prices should be materially lower today because of that simple mathematical fact alone. Yet they aren't yet. You know, we are seeing prices begin to nose over in a lot of different metros around the country. As you said, it's unevenly distributed. There's still some metros that are hanging in there. And time will tell what'll happen there. But just from this one mathematical element alone, you know, we would expect to see housing prices go down. So as you said, you know, there's sort of this standoff between sellers and buyers right now. And while transactions are so low, you know, it's kind of like things are frozen here. Like I said, it's like the guy who's, you know, just been thrown in the Arctic water, he's gotten into shock. Everyone's trying to figure out what happens next, right? Without mortgage rates coming down substantially anytime soon, do you see any reason, just based on the mortgage rate math alone, why we should expect the shock victim to recover versus starting to see organ failure, which I would call, you know, equate to much lower prices in markets from here?
So you're asking, like, is there a bullish case from here?
Yeah, well, I mean, so like you said, so, you know, things perked up a little bit at the beginning of this year, and it was because the narrative was trying to turn, right? Oh, maybe we're going to have a soft landing. Recently, there was this no landing, you know, trial balloon floated. And mortgage rates did tick down a little bit. They've since reversed and have started going back up again, but they didn't come down all that much, right? They're still much, much higher than they were a few years ago. And as you said, you know, we're pricing houses still in many markets at the same values of where they were when interest rates were 50% what they are now. And my point is I just don't see how that can sustain just from math alone, unless mortgage rates go down, or I guess incomes in all these markets go up by some tremendous amount tomorrow, which I don't think anybody's forecasting right now.
No, it's hard to envision that scenario. I think, again, this is all sort of based on that fantasy soft landing concept. I think that, you know, maybe markets were anticipating that the Fed would back off the rate hikes or even pivot at some point in 2023. So there was maybe, you know, uptick in activity with the idea of, well, if interest rates might be fives by the end of the year, fours, then I can buy a house now and refinance.
Got it. Later. So sort of a front running of the pivot.
Yeah, front running the pivot. I think that's really probably the only scenario that makes sense, because assuming, as long as we're seeing shelter inflation not coming down on CPI, I don't think the Fed is going to back off. And they may not, they may stop hiking, but they're going to hold to until they get what they want in the data. And I think in, as long as that is occurring, I do not see, like the mortgage applications data from yesterday's show, I do not see buyer demand overall. So I don't see any way that that's going to support prices or bring prices up. And data, recent data is also showing that investors, for the most part, have started to back off as well. The cap rates don't make sense right now. And now you've got well-funded, very well-capitalized investors waiting in the wings. And there's a lot of people who say, well, we can't have a housing crash because all these people have capital and they're just waiting for a bottom. But that is a valid point to some extent. But again, I think right now they're not buying, they're waiting. So right. If they're holding back and buyer, like residential, just family buyer is priced out or their demand is killed, there's no buyers. Prices are just going to keep going down.
Yeah. And we talked about this, I think, a bit in your earlier appearance during the Airbnb bust interview. But one thing that I harp on a lot on this channel for folks to remember about the housing market is that it's priced at the margin. Right. So it's almost like an art auction. Right. The painting goes for whatever the highest bidder is willing to bid for it. Right. And if the richest guy leaves the room before the bidding's done, then the question becomes, all right, well, how close to that guy's bid is the next guy? Was he a dollar away from it or was he 50% below it? Right. And I think that's what we're going to be finding out here now. There's a lot of data I know we're going to walk through pretty soon about how consumer balance sheets are suffering right now, right? You know, revolving consumer debt's going through the roof. Personal savings are getting down near record lows. People are now getting worried about their jobs, right? With layoffs and whatnot. So, you know, that shows that there's a fair amount of consumers that are kind of dropping out as buyers. We've had more institutional involvement in the residential real estate market than we've ever had before. And in some markets, I know some out near you live in Texas. There were some markets where, you know, back in 2021, I think like over 50% of the purchases were being done by institutions, right?
Yes. Tarrant County. Dallas County was pretty close to 50%.
Yeah. Which is bananas. And maybe we'll rail in a little bit about, you know, the pros, but probably the many cons of having so much of your housing stock owned by institutional investors. But you're saying even those guys are kind of sitting out at this point, right? So my point here is just like a lot of buyers are leaving the auction right now. So that importance of the marginal buyer really begins to kick into play, right? Hey, if those guys with the big pockets are beginning to leave, well, the guys that are left may not be able to bid anywhere near what current prices are, right? So, all right, Amy, lots to talk about here. If you don't mind, let's just help people kind of contextualize the situation we find ourselves in. Like, how did we actually get here? I know you got some charts that we'll probably talk about in a bit showing how, this market is really unaffordable, especially for younger generations in a way that's really never happened, at least in living memory. How did we end up in this world where houses became this ridiculously valued asset, given, you know, the incomes that are used to buy them, right? I mean, in theory, housing should be a multiple of local incomes, but I believe that multiple has gotten really distorted over the past couple of decades. So how did we end up here?
So basically, I would say the difference between like grandpa's housing market and our housing market today is, a lot of people say is, oh, it's the high interest rates versus the low, you know. No, the difference is that back in the day, I would say up until the early 2000s, I'll say the turn of the century is when this changed. Residential U.S. housing was not a speculative asset. People bought homes so they could live in a home. They assumed and generally got 3 or 4% appreciation annually. And you took on a 15 or 30 year mortgage with the expectation that you would pay it off, you would live in that home in retirement, and you would have your shelter costs taken care of.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, but it was almost sort of like a forced retirement vehicle, right? Like, yeah. I'm going to have a roof over my head. I'll be able to raise my family in it. And at some point in my twilight years, I will have all the equity in this building.
Yes. Yeah. And there was real estate investment back in the 80s and the 90s, but it was primarily commercial. There just wasn't, you know, half of the companies you see today, like the iBuyers, the Redfins, the Zillow, Airbnb even, they didn't exist back then. They didn't even exist. Those were all babies born of endless QE and ZIRP era. Okay. And, you know, when you, the thing I would, you know, hammer in, if you're a millennial or a Gen Z person and you're super frustrated with this housing market and you're like, my parents keep telling me I just need to drink less Starbucks and I should be able to afford a house. I would say, you know, dad, grandpa, whoever you are, when you went to go buy a home, you were not bidding against an iBuyer when you were buying a home. You were not bidding against.
Could you just define an iBuyer for the people that don't know exactly what that term means?
Sure. So iBuyers, Open Door is the one a lot of people think of first. And then there's Redfin. Zillow did it for a while, but they dropped out. It's just a company that buys homes and they buy them with the intention of flipping them or sell it, or maybe some of them rent it out. But I don't think so. I think their general business model is to sort of siphon real estate activity towards them. They make money on transaction costs as well. So they don't necessarily lose money if they sell the house for a slight loss, as long as they're gaining market share, because there's transaction costs involved with what they do as well. But their general business model is advanced flipping. It's what people were doing in like the 2005 to 2008 bubble, but people were doing that more individually. Now it's these companies that are doing that on a big scale, or trying to do that on a big scale.
Right. And I'm sorry, but just to underscore a point you just made a minute ago, these corporations are able to borrow at much lower rates than the average individual are. And they have the advantage of, because they're in the real estate industry and they facilitate transactions themselves, they have all of these economies of scale that the average individual doesn't have either. So if you're just a millennial out there trying to buy your first home, you're competing with this corporation that just has way more advantages than you in terms of what it's able to bid for that property.
Yeah. And again, this is underscored by a decade of zero interest rate policy and endless QE. These companies, most of them were founded in the wake of the first housing bubble. And they have spent a decade, I think Open Door did 9 rounds of fundraising. They have so much capital. They go in and they target entry-level starter home neighborhoods. And you've got, you know, this little couple and they're like, okay, well, this is our income and, you know, how much can we afford? And they come and bid on this house. And Open Door can easily come in and offer 10% over list, all cash. And, you know, if you're a seller in that market, you're going to look at that and be like, okay, this is all cash. It's a done deal. Like, that's going to be a very lucrative offer. And a regular family is not going to be able to compete with that.
Yeah. Okay, great. So thanks for defining what iBuyers are. But just again, another sort of example here of how it's a very different housing buyer market than it was when previous generations went to go start their household formation.
Yes.
All right. And then in terms of the way in which housing is financed, that's changed a fair amount too, right? I mean, you've had much more involvement in, you know, what were called these GSEs, right? These government-sponsored enterprises, right? Mm-hmm. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, everybody sort of hears those terms. But basically, they have become much bigger players in the loan market, right? So they've allowed more people, more players to get into the housing market. And obviously, more players, more competition, prices go up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've seen, I think the biggest change that we've seen with those companies is that the government has increasingly taken over. And it was really in 2008 that it was just like a full takeover. Because in 2008, we got direct QE for the first time with Bernanke. He just straight put the mortgage-backed securities on the Fed balance sheet, yep. bailed out the banks, took over majority control of Freddie and Fannie, and Ginnie is 100% controlled. So I think the stat I saw was that 70% of mortgage credit risk is now backed by US Treasuries on the Federal Reserve balance sheet to some extent. So basically what that means is the majority of mortgage credit risk in the US right now is essentially being backed by taxpayer dollars.
Okay. Yeah. And this is, look, I could rail a whole different other topic about the higher education system, but we've seen the same thing basically happen there, where the government has come in and basically become the pretty much the sole provider of education debt. And what has happened, right? The cost of education has gone through the roof. You have these students that graduate, you know, with a paper diploma and in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt. I think there's a lot of analogs that we can draw between the education system and the housing market here in terms of prices just getting so overinflated because of excessive government intervention that at the end of the day, it's actually really punishing the people in theory that it's supposed to be serving here. All right. Okay. So there's another chart too that I think you sent over here that shows the regional homeowner vacancy rate versus the mortgage-backed securities held at the Fed here. Not surprising, right? The Fed gives a lot more money. People are able to buy more houses. People who maybe shouldn't necessarily have qualified before now can qualify. They get in. The danger here, right, is that as the Fed begins to unwind the mortgage-backed securities that are on its balance sheet, which it's now in the process of doing, finally by doing quantitative tightening, we may start to see this trend reverse, right? We may start to see people not being able to stay in their homes. We might start seeing a lot more vacancy rates, basically as we sort of mean revert as that artificial stimulus gets pulled back from here, correct?
Correct. We may see that. I'm a little bit skeptical with how the Fed is rolling the mortgage-backed securities off the balance sheet. They're not even doing the maximum right now. They have come out and given good speak on, oh, we'll sell them someday. You know, maybe we'll sell them. But, you know, in the wake of the 08 crash, they had set the intention that this was like a one-time bailout thing. They were not going to always have mortgage-backed securities on their balance sheet. This was going to be like a one-time deal, and then they were going to roll them off. Obviously, that did not happen. They made a really pathetic attempt in 2018, and the market freaked out, and they backed off. And that's kind of what left us vulnerable for the pandemic, because then we were in a global pandemic, and we had a bull run in real estate for a decade, and we were stuck in this position where the market needed to be bailed out again. And so Powell comes in and he puts, like, I think he almost doubled. I think by April 2022, we had $2.7 trillion of mortgage-backed securities on the balance sheet. And in 08, right. it was in the one trillions.
Yeah, and so, I remember 2020, you know, latter half of 2020, 2021, the Fed was buying $60 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities every month.
Yes.
Yeah. So, all right. So basically, you know, we're in this pickle we're in largely because of excessive intervention, you know, at the government level, both with the Fed, with, you know, its purchasing of trillions of mortgage-backed securities, and with the government basically getting in, kind of taking over a lot of the mortgage lending basically just pumping a ton more liquidity into this market that was there before, right? So we've got this liquidity tsunami. Now it's starting to ebb a little bit. So we're going to find out where this is going in just a second. But of course, there are all these other dynamics as well, which, you know, I'll let you kind of, you know, tackle them any way you like. But one big factor you just talked about there was sort of the rise of the institutional buyers, right? So in addition to all the additional retail buyers we brought in with the, you know, GSE loans and stuff like that, you know, Fed lowered interest rates to record levels that enabled the business models of any institution, but certainly these new class of iBuyers and stuff as well to come in and start snapping this stuff up. So again, our poor little, you know, retail homeowner is just competing with way more people than previous generations of home buyers had to deal with. You know, I guess there's one other big factor here we haven't talked about yet. And this is how the various Fed puts also sort of changed the situation. Again, not for the long-term benefit of the first-time home buyer, at least here. Started with Greenspan, then was evolved by Bernanke. Can you talk about those just for a minute too?
Sure. I would say that is the pivotal thing that changed the US housing market. It was the introduction of the Fed put. Greenspan, in the wake of the dot-com bust, he is the one who, he started with indirect QE. And what you'll see with the history of the Fed puts is they tend to intensify in potency as each one has come up. So we started with indirect QE with Greenspan, but everybody went nuts with it. And that first US housing bubble was, you know, prior to the 21st century, we never had a national US housing bubble. We had some small boom bust cycles, and they were mostly regional and they tended to correlate with US recessions, but we never had home prices nationally collapse. And the reason that they nationally collapsed in that bubble was because speculators got involved. So it became a bubble. That was the first time we had a bubble. And when there's a bubble, there's speculation and there's going to be a popping of the bubble. The fuel for that bubble was that Greenspan put, because suddenly, for whatever reason, people decided, hey, there's this whole new asset class that hasn't been tapped, residential real estate. It always goes up. Historically, it's always shown that it goes up, and we can turn this into a new speculative vehicle. And back in that time period, it was flipping homes. People were buying, like you saw the Big Short movie, you know, regular people were buying four or five homes and then flipping them and just keeping taking out loans. The loans were really poorly regulated. So again, another thing that you see in a lot of speculative bubbles is people will find regulatory weaknesses and exploit them. So that was happening there too. And that obviously created this housing bubble in that era. And we found ourselves with this massive housing collapse in 2008 because the banks started to fail. They realized, hey, these are all these fraudulent loans. And that is where, once again, we got another Fed put. And this time it's Bernanke, and he comes in and he annies up, you know, and he's like, we're going to do direct QE now. We're going to put mortgage-backed securities on a balance sheet. We're going to take over control of, you know, Freddie and Fannie, and we're basically going to backstop the US housing market. To be fair, the case I can make for them is this. Their mandates are employment and price stability. At the time, I would say they probably thought we are contributing to price stability here because they were faced with a situation that we'd never had before. National collapse in home prices. Nobody knew where the bottom was. It was a global financial crisis. I think their panic move was probably like, this is going to be a backstop. We're going to stabilize this to get some sort of bottom, which you could argue that was what they were trying to do. And that would be fair or somewhat of a fit to their mandates. But obviously, if you extrapolate that out a decade later, their price stability mandates have gone out the window now.
I want to opine on this just for a second. You know, what you're talking about here, a lot of viewers, you know, it'll get their rage on, because this is what people mean when they refer to the Fed as the arsonist who then, you know, shows up as the fireman to put out the fire that he started, right? You know, the whole distortions and deformation of the housing market under Greenspan was not sustainable. It reached its unsustainable zenith. And as it fell, you know, Bernanke then took the torch from Greenspan and said, oh, well, we've got to step in and fix this issue. And you know, then there were the magazine headlines of the man who saved the world and all that stuff, right? That for those of us paying attention, we're super angry about, because we're like, wait a minute, these are the guys that actually caused all this, right?
And Nobel Prize.
Every rescue has to be bigger because the magnitude of the deformations get bigger, and it requires more to save the system to get it back on the unsustainable trajectory, which then of course makes it even more unsustainable. And when that crash happens, it's even bigger than the previous one, which needs a bigger intervention, right? That's sort of the cycle that we've been trapped in here, which is sort of why everybody has been referring to the asset price situation leading up to 2021 is the everything bubble, right? It wasn't just dot-coms like it was at the beginning of the millennium. It wasn't just housing like it was in 2007. Now it's pretty much almost every asset, right? I do want to share a chart here that shows the deformation in home values during this time. And what's so important about this chart is I remember this chart. I remember before we got to the July zenith here, where it began coming down in July 2006, if I'm reading this correctly. I remember versions of this chart when it was still just shooting the moon, right? And this is actually two things that are important about this chart. It kept me from buying a house out in Silicon Valley during this time. So I used this chart as probably the centerpiece in my logic for this looks like an aberrant housing bubble, right? We've had this ratio of prices that has pretty much persisted since 1890, right? It took a dip during the Great Depression and World War II. Okay, kind of understand why. Otherwise, it kind of hung out at the same index, and then it just started shooting the moon, right? So this was part of the data that said to me, something really aberrant's going on. Don't get caught up in this mania. And I'll tell you, for years, I looked like a crazy man to all my peers who were buying houses during this time. I was the guy that they liked to talk to at the party to be like, guess what this crazy guy, you know, thinks about housing? He says it's overpriced. We're all making money like there's no tomorrow. Then once it actually burst, I looked like a genius for a brief period of time before the Bernanke put was put into place. but most importantly, and this is why I wanted to stop briefly to opine on this, is the validation of this data that, hey, things did get too far distorted. The established media didn't pick up on it, and the average person didn't pick up on it. So they slammed into its repercussions like a brick wall. This is what put me on the path to found Wealthion.
Really?
So that's what's so important about this chart. I really credit this chart as almost kind of like my genesis into understanding the macro world, because I started by trying to buy a house myself. And I was so far outbid at crazy prices. I relatively recently graduated from Stanford Business School, and I was just like, why am I not understanding why people are willing to spend so much money for a depreciating wooden box? And once I found my way to that chart that we just showed, it really began making the tumblers click in my mind that, oh, okay, something historically aberrant's going on. And then I, you know, wandered over and, okay, what's causing this housing bubble? And then the rest is history here. But I want to thank you for bringing up this chart, because it really was an incredibly seminal one for me in my journey. Okay, enough about Adam. Let's keep going on here. So we've had the Bernanke put following the Greenspan put. Anything else you want to talk about that until we talk about the next version of the put, which is the Powell put?
No, I think just the biggest distinction with Bernanke coming in was the mortgage-backed securities. That was, the Fed had zero on their balance sheet up until that period of time. And now they've established that they have them on their balance sheet. And it is a shift, it's a paradigm shift for how the Fed operates with the housing market. And it's also, it's one of the hardest things for me to grapple with as I look towards the future of the housing market. I just haven't seen, I just haven't seen the government ever take control of something and give it up without course.
Absolutely. The whole long laundry list of that, including the U.S. fiat dollar, right? Nixon took closed the gold window temporarily, were his words. Well, 50 years later, we're still off the gold standard. So anyways, keep going.
And I'm of no relation to that Nixon.
Oh, that's right. I didn't even think about that. Okay, good.
Yeah, there is no bloodline there.
All right, great. So anyways, yeah, so that was Bernanke's contribution. Okay, now, you know, Janet Yellen, I'm assuming, you know, more or less just kind of carried the Bernanke put along, but then Powell comes into the picture. How do things change there?
You know, with the pandemic, the Powell put, I think history is going to show that it was a policy error. It was just too much. We obviously were in a crisis. We had never been in this situation before with this, or maybe as a Spanish flu, but this is like a century ago. We're in this global pandemic. Everybody's shut down in their homes. Businesses are closed down. We have no idea what this is going to do to the global economy. The housing market sort of came to a dead stop on its own because everybody was not leaving their house. So nobody's going to go tour and buy houses. So we just got this like bazooka of stimulus money and PPP loans and who knows what people did with those. And interest rates dropped into the twos, which all of these things combined at once just led to this insane speculative mania, which has been the last couple of years. And everybody saw it and everybody knew what was going on when it was happening with the meme stocks and the NFTs. And, you know, there's all these new speculative vehicles. And I would say Airbnb fits in that category too, because even though Airbnb existed prior to 2020, its growth went bonkers starting in 2020. Like if you look at a trajectory of their growth in number of Airbnbs, it's like it started going off the charts in 2020. And again, that was speculation.
Right, speculation and the record low interest rates, right? It made the economics work, right?
Right. And another point I would make to this too is I don't see compelling data that shows that we have a housing shortage in the country in the sense that we're underbuilt or that we don't have enough homes. Prior to 2020, we had a functional-ish housing market. There are people who think it was still overpriced back then, but
myself included.
I've gone back and forth on Dallas with that one, but we had a relatively functional amount of supply and demand for the residential housing market prior to the pandemic. Now you could argue there was new household formation in the pandemic and it obviously spurred demographic regional changes with people suddenly being able to work remote and want to move to different parts of the country. But that doesn't explain why inventory got tight throughout the entire country. That would explain why maybe it would be tight in these hotbed regions, but inventory was tight everywhere. And whenever you have this sort of scarcity type thing, it's because of speculation. It's not like the pandemic came and wiped all these homes off of the face of the earth and they just disappeared. What happened is the pandemic came and people suddenly started buying a second home or a third home or an Airbnb empire, or iBuyers were like, we're going to flip 10 homes in this neighborhood. That's what happened. And that is why inventory went so low. And that is why inventory right now is still so low, because everybody who bought all those homes are still hanging on to them because they have a low interest rate and they are kind of waiting to see what's going to happen with the right market. What's the Fed going to do? Do I have to sell this asset? I'm not yet in distress, so I'm not compelled to sell it yet.
Yeah, it is interesting. So I agree. I think the housing scarcity narrative has largely been a deceptive one. And we've had real estate experts on this channel who track inventory in a lot of key markets, and they've said, look, a lot of the hottest markets, they're actually going to be having an inventory excess problem going forward from here, because a lot of construction that's been in the pipeline for years is now beginning to come online right as things are cooling off, right? But I do think that you can make the argument that the average home buyer, their choices have been narrowed or diminished in number because of all the other buyers who are buying homes for other purposes than to actually live in them, you know, as a family, right? And now we have this great stalemate, right? We have all these people hunkering down, both institutions and, you know, retail homeowners that, as you said, they're sitting on, you know, maybe 3% mortgages, right? So as long as their cash flow continues, they're going to be okay. That's a really big question right now, I think, in my mind. And I know we're working our way up to, you know, so what does the future look like here? But I have said many times, and I'll still say, you know, homeowners are acting as a herd right now. Hey, if we all remain in solidarity and we don't sell, you know, then prices don't have to come down. But as I said earlier, houses are priced at the margin, and there's always going to be some organic number of transactions that just have to happen, right? People die, they get divorced, they have to move for other reasons, right? And those transactions are going to be what start to set the new prices in these markets. And, you know, I live out in the Bay Area. I don't see this yet in my particular housing market, but apparently the data says that the median home price in San Francisco, the city, has come down 35% since the May high of 2022, right? That's a really big change already, right? And I think that that's, you know, that's the margin. Those are those marginal transactions that are driving that repricing. And at some point, the more vulnerable players in the herd that's trying to hold together right now are going to start bolting, because they're going to realize there's a first mover advantage, right? If I'm a older person and my home is my biggest asset, and my home equity there is what I was sort of depending on to fund my retirement, if I'm worried that that's starting to erode value and I think it could fall further in the future, at some point I'm going to say, I'm going to sell now, and I'm going to try to at least capture 85% of what I had versus riding it down, right? On the institutional side, you get the danger of, we saw a little bit of this with Zillow, who you said is you know, kind of gotten out of this market, but you get one of these firms or these funds that has thousands of units, and they get into, you know, cash flow troubles, they're going to just start dumping like lots of units at a time in a market because they have to survive at some point. And that could really depress prices really quickly. So there's a lot of risks out there once the dam breaks. Okay, so real quickly, before we get to talking about, you know, where does the market go from here? I know you sent me over some thoughts about, you know, what are the implications of the Federal Reserve having so much control over the housing market? Is this a good thing? Should it continue? Do you think it'll continue?
There's different answers to all those.
Yeah, tackle them any way you like.
Okay, yeah, I think there are some pretty heavy implications. Whenever the government gets involved with something, we as taxpayers need to ask ourselves, how is this serving our country? What are the policy outcomes? So in terms of homeowners in our country are the majority. Our current home ownership rate is, I think it's around 65%. So the majority of US citizens own homes, but we do have a large cohort who do not. And the majority of that cohort that doesn't own are young people. So it's sort of setting up like this generational clash between older people who own a home, maybe they own two homes, you know, and young people who don't own any home and feel like the market is too hard to compete in now. So there's this generational problem that we're going to have, and it's probably going to increase with time as the boomer demographic dies off, their votes drop off and are slowly going to be replaced by the younger vote. But I would say if we're going to have the government be in control of housing or backstopping housing, which you could argue is worth doing for the sense that we've got housing makes up 15% of the country's GDP. So there is a case for them protecting the housing market to some extent, because that is a big part of our economic activity. It's a big part. Housing is a big part of, like I said, 65% of people's retirements, their future. This is a big part of what enables consumers to spend and consume in the economy. We don't want to totally kill it, But at the same time, like I said, if the government is involved, we want a policy outcome that serves the country well. And I would say the number one outcome we should be measuring is an increase in homeownership rates. That is what we would want to see, more people owning homes. And we've gotten the exact opposite of that. In 1967, our homeownership rate was 64%. It peaked in 2004 at 69%. And today it's at 65%. So we've spent $2 trillion taxpayer dollars to support this housing market. And the policy outcome is we haven't increased our homeownership rate at all. And that's not what we would want to see for our country, because the more people that we have owning homes, the more stable we'll be as a society. We'll have more stable retirements for people. We'll have more improvement in demographics. You'll see younger people will be coupling more. They'll be marrying, they'll be having children, instead of what you're seeing in the current millennial and Gen Z generation is they're just putting all this stuff off.
Right. They're just stereotypical living at home with their parents into their 30s or longer. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we would want to see that policy outcome. And we would also want to see, like the Federal Reserve's mandate is price stability. We would want to see a housing market that has stable prices. And we have not had that. The last 3 years has been the most unstable that we've had prices be ever. We literally had prices going up, you know, 2 or 3% a month. And then when they slammed on the brakes this summer, like you said, I think San Francisco was the most obvious example that came up when I was looking at the data. Prices there were falling, you know, 2% a month in this fall. So we reversed course. And in some of these hot regions, now we're seeing prices are dropping almost as rapidly as they went up. But again, that is not stability. And nobody wants to participate in a market that has unstable pricing. So it's broken. Like the Fed put all this money into it and it doesn't work.
Yeah. So I'm going to put up one of my favorite demotivational posters that I show on this channel from time to time. And I'm paraphrasing it. I'm doing it from memory here. But it says something like, government, if you think the problems we create are bad, just wait till you see our solutions. Right. You know, it's just, I'm sure the viewers here are right here with you, Amy, which is that pretty much almost every time the government, you know, really gets involved in something, it tends to end up creating problems that were bigger than the issue that it got involved to try to create in the first point. You know, and I would say, look, you know, oftentimes the road to hell is paved with the best of intentions. Increasing home ownership rate, it's a noble goal. I think at times, you know, what that did, I heard that a lot in sort of the first housing bubble, which is sort of the justification of the government getting involved in with the GSEs and making, you know, giving these like, you know, 3% down mortgages to people who really couldn't afford the cost of true home ownership. And so it was getting people into homes who really were then saddled, you know, with the mortgage of the home. And it became a hardship for them in the same way, just in the education system that we sometimes push kids into taking out all these student loans that they really aren't going to be earning enough to service going forward. Right. I think affordability, you know, maybe even a better thing to look at, you know, come up with rational ways to measure what affordable housing is, perhaps based on a percent of income or whatnot, and try to find ways to maintain that type of price stability, right? Like, let's make sure that home prices don't far outstrip, you know, people's natural ability to pay for them, and we'll see. And one other thing that's also sort of impactful about this is a lot of the Fed's intervention, both on the housing market, but in the financial markets, have driven, you know, basically poured gasoline or rocket fuel on the wealth divide, right? And real estate is a very tax favored asset class, right? So there's a lot of benefits that have been accruing, I think, in large ways, sort of unfairly to homeowners, you know, throughout this process that you've been describing here, because they've made these wild returns in their home value. They've enjoyed these rock bottom, artificially suppressed interest rates. So their costs of homeownership have been very low on a relative basis. And they get all these tax benefits. And the poor people who can't get in the game, who are renting, have been just paying through the nose for this, right? Because they haven't been able to participate in all those benefits. And yet rents are a function of what home values are. And so rents have gone up to basically, you know, match the increase in home prices themselves. So these poor people are not getting access to the benefits, and yet they're having to pay more and more, right? And of course, now that we're in this huge inflationary era, I mean, they're really just getting squeezed. So, you know, there's a lot of unfairness that spirals out of this policy here. Okay, so where to from here? You know, the housing market doesn't necessarily have to act based on how Amy Nixon or Adam Taggart think it should. So when you look at just sort of what's likely to happen from here, we now have markets that are rolling over because a lot of these artificial props are now getting taken away, right? Interest rates are going up, mortgage rates are going up. The liquidity spigots have been turned off. The Fed's actually trying to drain the pool now in terms of its holdings of mortgage-backed securities. Where does it all go from here?
At this point, I'll give you what I think is the most likely outcome. And then I'll give you the outcome that I want, but I don't think we're going to get. So I think the most likely future that we have is home prices are going to come down further. This bubble that we've been in is going to continue to collapse through 2023, possibly into 2024. We will eventually, I think the Fed is going to hold rates high enough that for long enough that something will break and we will see distress. We will see some of these over-leveraged, I think there was just something today, like PIMCO, one of these big commercial real estate lenders just defaulted on like a $1.7 billion loan. But we're going to start to see more of these defaults and people distress selling. And that's going to restore supply and demand balance. And that's going to create lower prices. And the bubble will deflate the same way as the 07, 08 bubble deflated. But unfortunately, what I think will happen is the Fed is going to come out with QE, I don't know what level we're at, 13, 14. And it's going to be some new version. They're going to unroll some new fantastical thing like, oh, look, a 50-year mortgage, or we're going to do 1.5% interest rates. They will find a way to perpetuate the debt cycle, to kick the can further. And I think that as long as the markets believe in that, and they do, and that is the problem that I'm seeing with this current correction, even now, the markets really believe that that Fed put is there, and it's going to backstop them at some point, which takes a lot of the risk off the table for investors. So I have people, even now, with prices terribly high, this is not a good market for investing, in my opinion, in a lot of investors' opinions. The cap rates are awful, and you would not consider this to be a time when you want to buy. But I get DMs on Twitter all the time from people who are like, I have money and I want to buy residential real estate in Dallas and hold it. When is the bottom of the market? And yeah. I'm like, I don't know when the bottom is, but they're like sharks. They're so hungry to get this real estate, because even if they mistime the bottom, they really truly believe the Fed will backstop again. And in the long run, their investment will pay off. Even if they're off by a couple, you know, a year or two, they don't get the lowest price. Whatever the next bubble is going to have a higher price for. So they're going to come out ahead. That is what I think is probably going to happen.
Okay. Explains why, you know, another reason, like you said earlier, why the transaction volume is so low, because these folks are basically just sort of waiting for it, right?
Yeah.
And to your point too, like, again, the investor doesn't have to pick the absolute bottom here for two reasons. If they expect that the Fed is going to pivot, right, that means at some point the Fed will bring down the cost of debt again, right? So you'll be able to refinance. So as long as you get a lowish price, right? Well, then you can refinance it when the Fed comes in and brings us back to 1% interest rates, or releases the 50% interest mortgage at 1% or whatever it is, right? And then if the Fed then, you know, puts a bunch of stimulus in there, and then housing prices double from here, right? You get the best of both worlds, right? You get what looks like a bargain price with really cheap debt that the Fed is actively goosing back to new highs again.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is kind of the outcome that I think is the most realistic outcome. That is not, I know you've had Danielle on here and she has talked about Powell being the guy that's going to end the Fed put. And I would love to see that happen. I think that would be the best thing that could happen to our residential real estate market. It would get really, really ugly for an extended period of time if that actually did happen. But I think long-term, that would be what it would take to restore balance to the market and to ultimately get rid of all of the speculators. Because what we really need to do is get rid of all of the speculators. If we want to return the housing market to something functionally normal again for regular people in the country. So it really what has to happen is Powell has to be that guy. I know, you know, I really want him to be that guy, but like, I just, you know, he reminds me of these guys I dated in my 20s where I'm like, I really think you can be this guy, but I don't know if you're going to do it.
Oh gosh. Just one more man that a woman hopes will change who never will. Right. But yes,
he's got the potential. He's, he's shown, you know, he's come out, he's done these rate hikes. He's done the rate hikes. You know, he was wrong on the transitory thing, but he turned around, he did the hikes. And Danielle did predict that. And she was right. You know, he was able to stick to that and to do these hikes at the fastest pace that we've had in history. So I will give him credit where credit is due. But that being said, I'm not seeing hopeful signs like they're not selling mortgage-backed securities off the balance sheet. The FHA, whatever, the Federal Housing Authority that sets the conforming loan limits, they're raising them. They just raised them to $1 million in a lot of regions of the country for 2023. So again, that is enabling people to take more debt, and that's going to support high asset prices.
Right.
Those are not policy things that you see with somebody who, I'm just getting mixed messages from Powell. He's saying, I want this housing reset, but then he's also, you know, not selling any mortgage-backed securities, enabling these conforming loan limits to go higher. I'm just getting too many mixed signals for me to be confident that he's really going to be the guy that just says to the markets, like, this is done. This era of QE and ZERP is over. Like, we can't continue to sustain our country this way, and we got to put an end to it.
Yeah.
That's what I hope for.
But it's so tiresome to have this exact same question come up here in this discussion around housing that I have pretty much with everybody every day of the week on this program around the financial markets, where it really all comes down to what this one organization decides to do, right? The Fed, which I think in itself is a sign of an unhealthy, unsustainable system where everything pivots around the decision that a couple of people around a table, you know, decide to make. And we've had lots of discussions about, do we even need a Fed? Could we just have, you know, a market setting interest rates and just let the market find the true fair levels? But we don't have that. We have what we have right now. And Amy, I think, you know, it's really interesting. So I think this is the question going forward, right? Which is sort of how much backbone does Powell and or his successors have in trying to, you know, clear out the excessive speculation that's gone into the system. You know, if history is a basis for judgment, I think your fears will be totally proven right, right? I mean, that's what the Fed has showed us again and again. So we'd kind of be with the definition of insanity, right? Is expecting a different outcome from the same thing over and over. So we might be a little insane to have hope here. That said, to your point, you know, Powell has been saying the right things. He has definitely been talking tough. And since he pivoted to tightening and hiking, he has been consistent. And I will give him that. I think the biggest question out there is just, no matter how convicted he is in his mind, will something break badly enough that he just can't stand, that the pressure just becomes too great, that rests again, whether it's in the system, whether it's a conflagration in the U.S. housing market, you know, it remains to be seen. But I think we got to sort of plan, you know, we got to plan for it. So anyways, let me sort of start trying to wrap this up. And I do want to ask about for an update on the Airbnb bust in just a moment. But Amy, one of the reasons why I really value talking to you is not only just for your command of the real estate market and your macro outlook, but you are a millennial. You are younger than many of the guests I have on this program. You know, you are a parent. You know, your generation has it pretty tough right now. I put up a chart earlier. I'm going to put up again that shows home ownership rates by generation here. And you can see that the millennial generation is far behind Gen X and the boomers and the silent generation here. And to a certain extent, you would expect it because they're younger in their journey. They should be not quite at those heights yet, but I believe they are pretty substantially behind in their ownership rates than when previous generations were their same age, right? So, you know, kind of as a millennial, and I don't know if you're a homeowner or not, but you know, you spend a lot of time talking to people that are looking to buy homes. You know, what's it going to be like for these younger generations here? It's really tough out there for them right now.
It is. And you know, the question I get asked most often on Twitter is, should I buy a house right now? Or, you know, what do I do? I want to buy a house. I'm a renter, or, you know, I've been looking to buy and I don't know what to make of this market. And it's a really hard question because of all the things that we've talked about in this interview. Like, there's just these unknowns with what the Fed is going to do. And I think the Fed is controlling so much of the market now that it's not really a free market, and you can't expect it to operate as a free market. So with that said, I generally will tell people, and this is not going to be a lot of millennials, but if you can afford the payment and you think you're going to live in the house for a decade or longer, and you have relatively good employment security, you may as well buy a house when you find one that you like, no matter where the market is at. Maybe you're not going to get the best price, but there is a human element to housing too that pays returns and dividends that aren't financial. Like, you're giving your family stability, you're getting into a neighborhood you want to be in, you're securing a school district for your kids. If you can afford the payments, then I think it's okay to buy when you find a home that fits your criteria. But unfortunately, that is so few millennials right now with where prices and rates are at. So then I thought about this for a long time because I was really struggling with how to answer this question, honestly. And I am going to approach it from a downside risk scenario. So evaluate the downside risks of your two options. You need shelter. You can either buy or rent. So if you buy and you time the market wrong, you know, you're buying this year and the market continues to go down for another 2 years. If you lose your job or get divorced or get sent to another state to work, and you find yourself in a position where you have to force sell that house and say it's at a 15, 20% loss. So you're losing your entire down payment when you sell the house plus transaction costs. Can you live with that? Are you going to be financially okay? Is that something that you, is that a risk that you're willing to take? And if the answer is yes, then, you know, maybe it's okay for you to buy. But you have to then look at what's your alternative. If you're not going to buy, you're going to rent. Now, there's, in my opinion, two downside risks to renting. Number one, and I know that you've seen this in the Bay Area, is if you are, again, wrong about the timing of the market cycle, and instead of prices going down, they continue to just go up and up and up. And you find yourself with your income and your capital not able to keep up with that inflation. You may be priced out of your market. And that's a big downside risk, because once you're priced out, it's pretty hard to play catch up from behind. And then you end up in a situation where you got to do crazy stuff like move to Texas to buy a house.
That's pretty crazy.
I know, right. So, and we've seen a lot of that. It's extrapolated that the same affordability problem to other parts of the country, but it's rational for people that want to buy homes. If they're priced out of the region, they really want to be a homeowner, you know, and if they can work remote or find a job somewhere else, it makes sense. And then the other downside risk to renting is if you just have to understand that you're signing a lease and you're at the mercy of your landlord. So when your lease expires, you could be presented with a rent that's $500 a month more. Or your landlord could say, hey, you know, I've decided to sell this house and, you know, it's not going to be for rent anymore. Then you are in a forced move scenario in whatever housing market condition the market's in when that happens. And you have to be able to say, okay, can I live with that? You know, if I take that risk, you know, that's going to be the downside risk of the rent and wait method. So there's downside risks on either side. And it honestly just comes down to the individual person or the couple. But I would say if you're a couple, make sure you agree on whatever you're doing, because if you find yourself in the downside risk scenario and one person was pushing more heavily for one option versus the other, there could be resentment.
That's a great point. That is a great point. All right. Well, really well said. And that's a good reminder of, you know, what I like to remind people of, which is the when it comes to investing, the research is really clear that we feel that the pain of a loss twice as intensely as we feel the joy of a gain here, right? So I like your framework there of saying, okay, which route, if we're wrong, can we live with more, right? All right, on the flip side of that, you know, this could be a pretty good moment of opportunity, even if there is a Fed pivot at some point in time here. You know, past housing declines, and Nick Jurley's done a good job of pulling out the data on this, and past housing market declines, the market has continued to decline for usually years after the Fed has reversed policy and started cutting rates again. So a Fed pivot doesn't mean that home prices go up tomorrow, right?
Right.
So either Powell kills the Fed put and doesn't pivot anytime soon, and we have a real housing market sort of washout, or he does, but we still have downward momentum for at least quarters or maybe a couple of years. There is the opportunity to get in at lower prices than today's still near record prices, and then benefit from an opportunity to refinance your house at lower rates, you know, when the Fed policy pivot has kicked in. So, you know, if you are a homeowner and you haven't found your forever home that you know you can afford, which you're saying, hey, if you just find that, just get it, right? Because you're going to get your total basket of returns, financial and otherwise, is still going to be net positive. But if you don't have your forever home waiting for you right now, patience probably, you know, there's a higher probability than there's been in past years that patience is going to benefit the potential aspiring homeowner here. You're nodding a little bit when I'm saying this, but I want to make sure I'm not putting words in your mouth here. What do you think?
No, I agree. That's a pretty good summary of what I said. Yeah, we have to operate under the market conditions that we've been taught over the last 20 years exist. It's not realistic to just say, well, I think the market should be this way, so I'm going to respond as if the market was that way. The market is what it is. You may not be buying the exact place in the housing cycle that you want to be buying in. But again, you need a place to live and you have to make the choice the best that you can with what your options are, because there's not really a great option, frankly, for anybody right now. And that's why you see nobody wants to participate in this housing market. Nobody wants to sell. Nobody wants to buy.
Yeah.
Like, there's the winners who have their dream home locked into a 30-year 2% rate.
Right. And then they're not leaving until they die. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Which again is sort of going to be some of the legacy from this series of puts and everything, no matter what happens in the future, is there just going to be some folks that got the winning lottery ticket here. And it's funny, you mentioned, you know, that at some point the housing stock's going to have to transition from the older generations to the younger generations. And what's so interesting is we have this dynamic where the younger generations just can't afford these prices, right? But of course, the older generations are assuming that they are going to sell at current prices or better to them, right? So there's this really interesting sort of mismatch right now, where it's kind of like, I can't wait to sell my house to you and get a whole bunch of money for it. And the younger generation saying, okay, boomer, well, maybe, maybe not. Maybe I won't buy your house, or maybe I'll buy it for a fraction of what it is. And one thing, and I'm not trying to push a narrative or push an agenda here that, hey, I think we're going to have great housing buying opportunities in the future. Although, showing my cards a little bit, I think probabilities are better than not that patience is going to reward you here if you're an aspiring home buyer. One benefit you have if you are is that short-term treasuries are paying you a fair amount of money to wait now, right? The U.S. 1-year treasury is now above 5%. So if you've got money that you're keeping on the sidelines to use as a down payment for a home, well, you can actually park that in a 1-year treasury, wait for potentially lower prices, and now get paid, you know, something relatively material on that, which you couldn't get over the past 10 years. So it's not a bad time, or let me put it this way, the conditions are much better today than they've been in a long time for the patient home buyer here. So let's use that as the transition to talking about your update on the Airbnb bust, and then we'll wrap things up, Amy. But I imagine the fact that capital can get a nice, safe 5% return is creating a lot of issues for the short-term rental market, because as you were saying earlier, the economics of that market have kind of been turned upside down now, with mortgages, you know, going through the roof. And probably, we haven't really talked about this, but I'm probably thinking oversaturation in certain markets and whatnot. So all of a sudden, you know, people that might have put their money into the short-term rental market are saying, all right, I could just put it over here and risk-free treasuries and maybe get a better return.
Yeah, we've seen, I think there was a big article at the Super Bowl saying how like half these Airbnbs around Phoenix were empty, they were vacant. We're starting to see the effects of this oversupply on the market, which is something that I talked about during that previous interview. And I think I was pretty clear during that interview that I in no way was saying that I think Airbnb as a company is going to fail. I was referring to individual investors who maybe got over leveraged, a little bit greedy with these loans and what they thought they could cash flow the properties for, just not being realistic to pull forward into a recession or a loss of that post-pandemic travel demand. The bust was referring to individual Airbnb operators, because it is entirely possible that Airbnb can thrive and have good earnings as a company while individual users start to go under or drop off or fail. I'm not sure how their growth model works long-term though, because I think if they're pushing for people on their platform to make money, like there's going to be oversaturation in almost every market eventually. Right. Listings are going to cannibalize one another. And I don't know how that extrapolates out. Although I do know that, as you know, they own a platform, so they have a lot of power over the whole market. I mean, the pricing, and it's the data. They're mining data is what they're doing with these landlords, these users of their platform. So they are getting access to things that they, you know, it doesn't necessarily, their business model isn't just like how profitable is everybody's individual Airbnb. They've got a lot of power. They are gathering data. They're using it to move the market. So I'm not saying Airbnb is going to fail. The only thing I would say about Airbnb is, in terms of failure, is Airbnb has yet to prove itself in a recession. Mm-hmm. It was founded in 2007. I think Brian Chesky and his roommate could not afford their rent in San Francisco. So they came up with, hey, let's rent out a spare bedroom on Airbnb. Now, you know, 15 years later, they've extrapolated their problem to everybody else in the country, but conveniently they have a solution for it. You can Airbnb your room too. But we did see a little bit of a glimpse. There were a couple articles that came out and they kind of got overlooked because the pandemic was so shocking. But there were some articles that came out actually in like May of 2020 that were talking about Airbnb owners who were over leveraged and terrified that pandemic travel shutdown. And they were like, we're going to go under. We don't have, we took out way too much, borrowed too much money.
My revenue stopped, but my cost didn't. I still have to pay those mortgages every month.
Right. And they got bailed out by the Powell put. But, you know, if we actually have an actual recession that we're allowed to have as a country, then, you know, that's going to be where Airbnb really gets put to the test, because travel is going to be one of the first things to go in a recession.
Right. So since we talked about this, Amy, and folks, if you didn't listen to that interview, if you're interested in this topic and diving really in depth into it, I'll put up a link to it right here. But Amy, since we talked about that, you know, a couple really material things have happened. One is the cost of capital has continued to go a lot higher, right? The mortgage rates have continued to go higher. So again, back to the math problem that I talked about at the beginning of this interview, you know, a lot of these people are all of us, especially if they had, you know, floating rate mortgages. I don't know how many do, but if you have floating rate mortgages, all of a sudden, you know, your cost of carry is getting a lot more expensive. If you're a new entrant in this market, the economics look a lot worse to you because you're just having to pay a lot more for your mortgage. So you've got that in play. But then, you know, there have also been a lot of articles written, I think, since we talked about people's frustration with Airbnb's pricing model and a lot of reasons for it. But essentially, the net result is that people are saying, wait a minute, it's now as expensive, or in a lot of cases, more expensive to stay in an Airbnb than a hotel. But I have all these other sort of like limitations or constraints or just, you know, bummers of renting from an Airbnb, like the host is making me clean before I leave and do the dishes and vacuum. And in certain cases, your story's like mowing the lawn and things like that. And of course, the way the pricing was being presented to people, it was like, okay, you can rent this place for, you know, $200 a night. Okay, I'll rent that because it's one of the more affordable things. And then when you actually get to pay, oh, well, there's a $500 cleaning fee. And you're like, whoa, wait a minute. So there seems to have been this backlash where people are beginning to say, screw that, I'm just going to stay at a hotel. And hotels are happy to have me. They were shut down in the pandemic. They've really upped their game to please me. And I can just relax. And, you know, so how big of a threat is that? Is that something that Airbnb is able to bounce back from? Or is that kind of challenging the model itself?
Airbnb has a major PR problem right now. The things that you just mentioned constantly go viral on Twitter. They constantly come up in articles. There are sort of two sides coming at Airbnb. One is the regulatory aspect of it, and one is this brand management, brand reputation problem that they have compared to hotels. Because when you're renting, or when you get a hotel, you're paying for consistency of experience. You know, within a certain bandwidth, what kind of customer service you're going to get. If you have bad customer service, you know, there's some level of, you're going to, can expect somebody's going to help you. They're going to solve your problem. Maybe you'll get your money back. There's a corporate system in place that's going to be accountable to it. With Airbnb, it is totally random. You don't know who your host is. You could get a great host. You could get a terrible host. Airbnb as a company does not do a lot to get involved with the conflicts between the guests and the host. It's sort of like you duke it out and you hope that you got a good one, because you might not get your money back. They might argue with you. They might send you mean text messages and be like, you're a terrible guest. I've given you a bad review. If you're paying, you know, $3,000 or $5,000 as a family to go on a vacation, you know, how much are you willing to risk getting that downside scenario where you get the really bad Airbnb operator that is going to ruin your vacation essentially, versus, hey, maybe I really would have liked that bigger space for my family, but if I go to a hotel, I've got a relative degree of certainty I'm going to get room service and they're going to have nice clean towels. They're not going to charge me all these extra things. And if something's broken or wrong, it's going to be corrected pretty quickly. So there has been this sort of resurgence of the hotel in this era. And that has to do mostly with just the customer service level that you're going to get at a hotel versus Airbnb. But I do think there is another piece at play, which is the regulatory piece. And that is just people are fed up with Airbnbs, hotels in their residential neighborhoods. And you're starting to see, I know Arlington, Texas just cracked down. Like they're like some parts of the country are banning Airbnbs in residential neighborhoods. So they're capping how many you can have.
Yeah, that's other parts happen of the in my country, area too, the capping. Yeah.
They're capping. And other parts of the country aren't. So right now it is just this minefield of regulations and nobody really knows what direction that's going to go. It is unfolding as I do this interview. Like it's changing constantly. We had a bunch of new stuff put in place at the start of this year, but I definitely think that's going to play a role too. And, you know, how much are people willing to risk opening an Airbnb when there could be new regulations coming that make it difficult for them to operate it? On top of the fact that right now the cost of capital is insane. And to your point earlier, 24% of the loans are variable.
Okay. Yeah. So a quarter of these guys just saw their cost of capital, you know, more than double, basically, if they've been in the market for more than 2 years or 2 years. All right. Well, look, Amy, I feel like I need to have you back on just to go even further into the short-term rental scene. And folks, if you'd like a more detailed update on the Airbnb bust, let us know in the comments section below. All right, Amy, I still have other questions that I wanted to ask you, but I'm looking at the time here. We are way over budget that I promised you we'd have here. I guess two questions for you as we wrap up here. The second one's going to be, where can folks go to learn more about you and your work? But is there anything else about the current housing market environment that we didn't talk about that you think is important just to put on people's radar?
I guess I would close just with a reminder that housing moves really slow. So people have been talking about a crash for a long time. And you have to understand that it's a slow moving process. You can't just look at 1 month, like look at January where there was this little burst of activity and draw conclusions on that. You have to look at the overall trajectory over several months to a year to see where prices are trending. And to remember that there could be aberrant months in there where there's a little spike of activity or prices look like they might be stabilizing. Just remember, it's a really long, slow process. I think it took like 4 years for the bottom to come in after the 08 crash. So just keep in mind that housing moves really slowly.
That's a great point. And I think, you know, emotions can drive our decision making. And in housing, you have the luxury, I guess, to a certain extent, of time, where it's not like the environment is going to change completely in a couple of weeks or next month. So make your decisions calculated ones. All right, Amy, well, look, super fun to have you on. Thanks for giving us so much of your time. Thanks for being here in video, in person. It's fun to actually see you when I get to talk to you. For folks that have enjoyed this conversation and would like to follow you, where should they go?
Just follow me on Twitter. I'm Texas Runner DFW. I don't have a book. I don't write articles. I don't have anything else to offer, but now.
But you have a very active Twitter account, which I follow, and many of the folks who come on this program follow. Amy, you're a very welcome new voice in the Twitterverse, in the Fin Twitterverse. All right. Well, look, folks, in wrapping up here, if you've enjoyed this conversation with Amy, would like to see her back on the program again, please both let me know in the comments section below, but also let me know by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Two quick reminders as well. We will be talking further about the actual, like, just reams of data about where the housing market is in Wealthion Spring Conference, which is coming up in just a little bit less than a month. To find out more about the conference and to register for it, just go to wealthion.com/conference. And if you can't watch the conference live, it's all online. It's going to be on Saturday, March 18th. If you can't watch live, don't worry. Everybody who registers will get a replay of the videos and all the live Q&As as well with the speakers after the event concludes. And lastly, you know, it's a deciding, you know, to buy a house in general is a big life decision. Making that decision in a market this uncertain is a really tough one for most people. If you're wrestling with a decision to buy or sell or rent at this point in time or invest, you know, highly recommend that you avail yourself to the counsel of a professional financial advisor. I know I say this on this channel every week in terms of the financial markets, but you know, housing is every much as much of an asset in your portfolio as the stocks in your portfolio as well. And so getting the counsel of a professional financial advisor who understands all the macro housing issues that Amy and I have discussed here can be really helpful in helping you think through your decisions. If you have a good advisor that can help you do that, great, stick with them. If you don't, highly suggest that you have a free consultation with the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. Doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service they offer. To set up one of those free consultations, just go to Wealthion.com. Amy, it's been a true pleasure. I hope we can have you back on the program again soon.
I would love to come back.
All right. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.